on the Hour, sponsored by Progressive Insurance.
I'm Matt Piper. Although Labor Day is in the rear view, it is still summer, and they're certainly feeling it from Arizona, where they've seen triple digits every day since May 27th, to Southern California, where temps could hit near 120 this week. CBS News Los Angeles reporter Rick Montanez says there's now new equipment just as red flag warnings for wildfires go up statewide.
There is new firefighting equipment on assignment. It's the first time Cal Fire was able to use the C-130 Hercules aircraft to fight a fire, dropping 8,000 gallons of fire retardant on the flames. Seven C-130s will soon help crews contain California wildfires.
The Justice Department announces criminal charges against those responsible for the October 7th attack against Israel.
Attorney General Merrick Garland says the charges against Hamas leader Sinwar and other militants include conspiring to provide material support to a foreign terrorist organization, resulting in death. Garland made his announcement via video.
They perpetrated the deadliest massacre of Jews since the Holocaust.
And Garland said these charges will not be the last.
We will pursue the terrorists responsible for murdering Americans and those who illegally provide them with material support for the rest of their lives.
That's CBS's Linda Kenyon. Dozens of people were killed in Ukraine when officials say Russian missiles struck a military training facility. The BBC's Nate Bigg has that.
Ballistic missiles came in and people really had very little time to try and seek shelter. Russian military bloggers and others have been saying that lots of cadets were killed. Now, that has not been confirmed, but the Ukrainian military has said that soldiers are among the dead.
Neither presidential candidate was out on the campaign trail today, even with Election Day just 9 weeks away. CBS's Skylar Henry says voters in at least 10 states, including Florida, have measures related to abortion on the ballot this fall.
The fight over reproductive rights is a major topic in this year's presidential election. The campaigns are expected to focus on that and several other top issues over the course of the next 2 months, including immigration and the economy.
Stocks had their worst day since an early August sell-off. CBS News business analyst Jill Schlesinger on what's going on.
A nagging worry that investors have that the economy is slowing down by too much. And the culprit was weaker than expected manufacturing data, in addition to a warning from Goldman Sachs about the slowdown in demand from China.
A collection of ancient silver coins has been unearthed on a small island in the Mediterranean Sea. The treasure trove dates back to more than 2,000 years. Archaeologists found the coins hidden in a hole in the wall while performing restoration work on the Acropolis of Santa Teresa and San Marco near Sicily. This is CBS News.
Sponsored by Progressive Insurance, we offer auto, home, and commercial auto insurance, plus a variety of business insurance options. Visit progressive.com today.
The Kitchen's Open on WFHR, a feature within the morning show every Monday at 9. Join me, Melissa Kay, and my guests to learn about food-related topics that will interest and entertain.
Do lots to talk about. Interesting NBC story the other day that I came across about Elon Musk. Evidently, his endorsement of Donald Trump seems to have backfired because people are going, hey, wait a second. Two billionaires talking about firing striking workers and yucking it up? Is that what we want? The idea that Trump was praising Elon Musk, effusive with praise, for a guy who fired workers who were on strike. And said, oh, you would be so good at the broader thing. You know, all those workers, just get rid of them. And what it's done, I think it's awakened some of the red hat base who are in that, hey, that could be me. Because we've gone through a couple years of, well, workers who have done pretty well for themselves because of their unions and their union contracts, because they were able to have that arrow in the quiver of maybe we might have to go on strike to get management to bargain fairly. Imagine taking that out. Imagine what things would look like at the bargaining table if there was no ability to strike. If there was no ability for workers to go, we're going to withhold our labor. We're going to fold our arms and we're going to march on the streets. We're going to put our hands in our pockets and we're going to march our feet. Imagine how that negotiation would go, because there's no incentive for the employers to ultimately act, because there's no real repercussion. And this is what Republicans have told us they want. They want weak, ineffective unions. They want name in recognition in name only, but not actual unions. And if you look at their Project 2025, if you look at J.D. Vance's signing on to the TEAM Act, this idea that we can have suggestion box unions, but not real unions. It gives me hope that maybe we're waking up because, you know, I've been saying we're in the midst of the second Gilded Age. In this moment, it's really important to remember our history, especially the pivotal chapter in American history. You know, the good old days of the 80s and 90s. I mean, the 1880s and 1890s, that is. A time marked by rapid industrialization, economic upheaval, and really a stark difference between the working class and the elite. The CEO class, the wealthy, the captains of industry, and really everybody else. You know, the people who did the work. And look, at the center of this tumultuous period were our robber barons. And we termed them, the folks, the Andrew Carnegies of the world, the wealthy industrialists who accumulated massive amounts of wealth and power at the expense of the very workers who actually did the work, who built their fortunes for them. And to understand how working class Americans viewed these figures, you got to first recognize the context. The 1880s and 90s were characterized by horrible, grueling working conditions, long hours, poverty, wages, desperation. Workers toiled in factories and mines and on railroads, dangerous, dangerous jobs, with very little, if any, hope of ever seeing improvements. And oh, by the way, children in the workplace. There are tons of pictures of 5, 6, 7, 8-year-old kids smoking pipes, chewing tobacco, working in the mines and in the looms. On the other hand, you had the robber barons, the Andrew Carnegies, as I've said, the Rockefellers, the J.P. Morgans, who were able to amass enormous fortunes. Why? Well, because they had wealthy and powerful friends in government. They used ruthless business practices that prioritized simply profits over people. More for me and the heck with you. And look, for the working class at the time, the robber barons symbolized everything that was wrong with the capitalist system. Many saw them as exploiters, individuals who cared little for the livelihoods of them or their families. The working people be damned. The question that loomed over every laborer was simple, yet profound. Which side are you on? Now, you've heard me say this thousands of times, but this simple question encapsulated the growing awareness of class struggle at the time, a realization that the plight of the worker was not merely an individual issue. It wasn't just one person. It was part of a larger societal conflict between the wealthy elite and the working masses, the unwashed masses, the toiling class. And what you saw is labor unions began to emerge as a response. People started to come together and they advocated for better working conditions, for workers' rights, wages, hours, conditions. That's what they fought for. The Knights of Labor, for instance, sought to unite all workers, regardless of skill, regardless of trade, regardless of color, under this banner of solidarity. Their rallies and strikes were not just about the immediate gains. They sought to change the foundation of the economic system that allowed a few, a handful, to prosper while the many toiled, struggled, and suffered. The robber barons, in their pursuit of wealth, often responded with, well, hostility, violence. Strikes were met with clubs and, well, union leaders labeled troublemakers and radicals. You may remember me talking about the infamous Haymarket Affair of 1886. A stark example of this clash were a peaceful rally of workers and people fighting for better rights turned deadly, which led to a widespread crackdown of the labor movement. The ruling class's reaction only intensified the resolve of labor leaders for years. Workers fought. Their solidarity, the sentiment that their fight, their struggle was righteous, got us to where we had the most prosperous working class in the history of civilization decades later. Because you had workers who articulated their frustration. They did it through songs and pamphlets and speeches. They created a culture of resistance that resonated across the working class and the country. The rise of the labor movement was not just a fight for economic justice. It became a moral imperative of the time. The mantra of which side are you on echoed in the hearts of many, driving them to stand against oppression. And the thing is, as we reflect on that era, it's crucial to understand that the legacy of the 1880s continues to this day to influence our discussions about labor rights. The struggle for fair wages, the struggle for safe working conditions, just as relevant today as was then. And it reminds us of that question of solidarity and justice and our eternal struggle for that. The working class of this country, it's important to remember the era of the 1880s. Because the robber barons were not just the wealthy of the time, they were a symbol of systematic injustice. And workers fighting for dignity, fighting for respect, not just for themselves, but for the future. Asking the simple question, which side are you on? So today, as we advocate for better wages, hours, conditions, equity, and justice in this time, it's still a relevant question. So when we talk about tax policy that, hey, maybe we should be taxing the very wealthy at a much, much higher rate, which side are you on? Should corporate profits be used to buy back stock, to raise the investor class's wealth at the expense of workers? Which side are you on? The age-old question is exactly what it is. And our fight and our struggle continues. So as we have Labor Day in the rearview mirror, kind of important to remember. And I'm kind of hopeful that we've seen at least one billionaire and a wannabe billionaire talking about how workers should fare. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Gonna take a quick break. Right back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So while we've been talking about labor and we've been talking about how we save our economy and have a more fair, just economy for working people, some of the things we haven't talked about is national security. I haven't talked about it enough. Which is why I've grabbed Michael Smith. He is a former Rear Admiral in the United States Navy. He's the founder and president of the National Security Leaders for America. He's here to talk about what kind of commander-in-chief would Kamala Harris be and why this really is an important issue. Michael, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
So, you know, I'm looking at, you know, a lot of the stuff you see around here is all about labor, and it's all in my world and all this stuff that makes me thrilled to see.
But national security's kind of a big deal as well. The question about what kind of commander-in-chief Kamala Harris would be as opposed to Donald Trump. I want to get your assessment.
Well, thanks. I appreciate being here. I head an organization. It's over 650 former senior national security leaders. So we have retired admirals and generals and ambassadors, cabinet secretaries on down. And we came together initially to support Biden in 2020. But as Donald Trump and his creed have expanded, we're a pro-democracy organization, and we're here today really to send two messages. One, that to remind people of the threat that Donald Trump brings national security into America internationally, but also to your point just there is what a strong commander-in-chief that Kamala Harris is going to make.
Let's talk about the Trump era, because it's easy to forget. It's easy to have that historical amnesia. There are the comments out there that Trump called, you know, people who died in war suckers and losers. The comments about John McCain. I like winners, not losers, not people who have been captured. There have been all these comments out there from Trump that I struggle with why military people would be drawn to him, given what not only what he said, but a lot of things that have happened.
You know, I myself have that same quandary. You know, if you look at 2020, the polling results, Donald Trump lost 16% of his support from 2016 to 2020. You know, and then veterans vote at 15% rate of all the voters was 15%, Pew showed us. So overall, that means 2% of the vote he lost from veterans. And I want them to make sure to understand why they didn't vote for him before, and trying to get even more, because everything you say is so true that he's such a threat. And if you take a look at Project 25, what he's going to do with the military, it's just un-American.
Yeah.
You heard about these discussions he had in the Oval Office when he was president, and they were having Black Lives Matter marches, peaceful marches. I was on that march with my son through Washington, D.C. It was peaceful. Come to find out, he was having discussions in the Oval Office about, can we use Army Black Hawk military aircraft to disrupt these marches? I mean, that's what Project 2025 is going to bring back and going to authorize, and it's going to politicize the military, our strength that's always been that we're not partisan.
Right. No, and that's, for me, this is one of those issues where, unfortunately, we've taken things that should not be political, education, health care, our national security. When a president goes overseas, you don't attack them. It's become the norm these last 4 years since Trump has left office that the norm has been anytime Biden would do something overseas, it would be an attack on Biden. That, in my lifetime, has not been the norm. I fear that that is the norm going forward, though.
You know, how many every month, now week, whatever norm you're talking about, he's gone and violated.
Truth.
You know, how many times we said he's never going to sink this low, and then look what he did, what he said about the Medal of Honor. I mean, this guy knows no lower limit to where he will go to try and appease his base.
No, I was going to save that for a little bit later, but since you brought it up, I got to ask. As someone who has spent their life in the military, as someone who's spent their life around people who have sacrificed, what does that mean to you? I mean, on a personal level, not your organization, but you personally, what does that mean when you hear what he said that day on, well, you know, you're okay, it's a better medal, where I'm giving it out anyway?
It is so insulting. You know, it almost makes me cry to think that anyone would think that way. These unbelievably gallant individuals. Many, yes, you're right, President Trump. They did give their lives, but they gave their lives in an act of courage to save their fellow soldiers and sailors and Marines and airmen. These are our heroes, not somebody who happens to have a lot of money and donated it to my campaign. So since I can do it, I'm going to give you a medal. And isn't this a nice medal? Isn't she a nice lady? Because she's so rich. No, these are people who, many of them, didn't want to go there. They're not suckers and losers. They were out there defending their country because their country called upon them, you know, and they did something absolutely heroic, and you just can't compare the two. I happen to be on a commission where one of our commissioners is a Medal of Honor winner. That man threw himself on a grenade to protect his soldiers, and he lived through that. Yes, Donald Trump, he has injuries from that heroic action that, if anything, makes the medal more important.
You know, I think back when I grew up as a kid in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland back during the early 70s. I saw those men coming home from Vietnam who were basically just dumped into my community like trash. And I'll never forget, you know, the people that I saw, broken minds, broken bodies, horrible addiction problems. And I said when all of these wars and all of these actions started, the one thing that I hope we do in this misadventure is to ensure that those men who came back don't suffer the way that those men back when I was a kid suffered, that we don't treat them the same way, that we treat them better, that we make sure that they get all the medical care they need, all the treatment they need, all the help to support their family that they need, because we did call on them. And I look at Trump and all the rhetoric, and I look at all of the, you know, the bizarre statements and him saying that he's the best ever, the most pro-military ever, but he didn't live up to that. And I struggle with this every day because there's so much we're not doing. And I guess that's where my frustration is.
Yeah, this gets back to reminding people about what he did when he was in office. You're right that so much has been invested, thankfully, in our VA, in our research, in the hospitals, so we can take care of folks with traumatic brain injury. We can take care of folks that need prosthetics. You know, it's cutting-edge medicine that was developed so that any veteran in that situation, without doubt, can get to a veteran's hospital, will be taken care of for life. That's what we owe these people.
Absolutely. At the minimum.
At the minimum. And when he was president, he had three of his buddies down in Mar-a-Lago, you know, basically running the VA and trying to privatize this. So you couldn't, if you were one of those soldiers, you couldn't automatically get in there. It would be privatized so that those three individuals and their buddies can make money off of our heroes.
No, privatized and profitized. That's always the goal. But for me, maintaining the VA and strengthening and enlarging the VA to me is important because they have institutional knowledge that the rest of the private sector could never have. They deal with illnesses and ailments and things that soldiers go through that the rest of society doesn't. So by destroying the VA, don't you end up just destroying all that institutional knowledge and putting veterans in more peril?
Absolutely. We're not going back. You know, this is turning the clock on all of this research and all the advances we made through obviously very horrific actions between Iraq and Afghanistan. But not only is that knowledge that spread the United States, that became an international standard. There were other soldiers from other countries that were flown to the United States to be treated because we had developed that level of knowledge. And you're right. If you privatize that, that goes away. You know, and then what are we going to do the next time? Nobody wants to go to war. But I'm sorry, there's a lot of very bad actors out there that want to do harm because they want to advance their interests. And at some point, we may need that knowledge again. And Donald Trump is going to strip that away.
No, most certainly. And look, I'm not a pro-war person. But I do believe that sometimes you're backed into a spot where the old Teddy Roosevelt, walk softly and carry a big stick. I'm very pro that, which is why we need to have the strongest military possible, but use them sparingly has always been my view. Because, look, I know the people who are going to suffer for these things. People who are going to bleed and die are going to be poor and working class people across this country.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, we just have to keep track of that. We have to understand that. And the most anti-war people I know are those in the military.
Yep.
You know, no one in the military want joined to go to war. You join to provide that very deterrent you're talking about, that big stick. So that's why we haven't had another world war since World War II.
So let's talk about that because, you know, I look at my red hat friends who think only Donald Trump can keep us safe. Only Donald Trump can deal with Putin. Only Donald Trump can stop what's going on in Gaza and Israel. Only Donald Trump, the savior, can do that. Because they've sold themselves on this. It's internal for them. They think Kamala Harris is going to start World War III. Thoughts?
No, it's the exact opposite. Look at what Donald Trump is doing with Putin. You know, if he had the chance to be able to thwart that when Putin initially invaded parts of the Ukraine, he has told Putin that, you know, if my NATO allies aren't contributing the amount I want them to do, you can do whatever you want to them. Oh, my God. These are our allies. These are countries that have come and had
some
our
friend.
Back. After 9/11, yeah. They had our back. They came to Afghanistan and supported us to go after the people that attacked the towers and the Pentagon on 9/11. They didn't have to go outside of Europe. And so what he has done, not only just in Putin, but the whole idea of trying to undermine NATO, you know, that's just unforgivable. This guy is just not smart. You know, he's just saying stuff like we heard at the convention last night from one of his former spokespeople. He doesn't respect his base. He's just saying whatever he can to get these people to vote for him because they don't understand what he's really all about.
So let's talk about Kamala Harris then, because, you know, like you said, I fear Donald Trump. Just the appeasement that he would give would allow people like Putin or China to just roll over Taiwan or Ukraine. What kind of president do you think, what kind of commander in chief do you think Kamala Harris will be?
You know, I think that I think Kamala Harris is going to be an outstanding commander in chief. The role of a vice president is to go out and execute your job, but the limelight is on the president. So for 4 years, Kamala Harris has been out there engaging foreign leaders and visiting countries and messaging China. And when she went to the Munich Security Conference, she met with foreign leaders. We are now finding out after that historic prisoner swap that she wasn't just talking about national security. She was negotiating with these foreign leaders to try and convince them to let some of these murderers, for instance, in Germany, leave the prison and go back to Russia so we could get some of our American prisoners back. So she's in the background doing all of these things, and she's in the White House and in the Situation Room when all of these actions and discussions are being made. If you other them, Joe Biden, obviously there hasn't been a president with his foreign service experience and understanding of national security for years. But if you go from Biden, you have to go all the way back to the first Bush before you get a president that'd be entering the office with more experience than Kamala Harris has. And not just as vice president, as a senator, she was on the Select Intelligence Committee. So she was privy to the most sensitive information about what's going on in the world. She is absolutely prepared on day one. She will be a better commander-in-chief on day one than Donald Trump was when he left office.
Yeah, and for me, I believe she will continue what Joe Biden has done and pulling the world together instead of tearing us apart.
Absolutely.
And that organizing, because let's say there is a world war down the road. Do we not want to have friends and allies? Do we not want to be able to come together and maybe thwart that early on? I mean, there's a lot here that I fear down the road possible, but being together, we're always stronger.
I think that is what is galvanizing my group. All of them have served in these senior positions and understand what you just articulated. But the problem is, Donald Trump, it's not just that he's a friend to Vladimir Putin.
And sending love letters to the other one.
Yeah, he's also out there undermining what we're doing in Asia. You know, and he's going, when he was president, again, to remind everybody, he went to Japan and to the Republic of Korea, South Korea, and basically said, you got to pay us more money to have our troops there. Our troops aren't there just for them. Our troops are there for us, for our national interest, to keep Asia secure so that our trade and our flow and all the goods we want in the United States are freely flowing. And that's why we're there for our own national interests, not for Japan's and Korea's. Obviously, they happen to overlap. But you don't go say, hey, I'm here for my own good, give me more money.
Yeah.
But people are forgetting that.
No, it's crazy. Lastly, I want to ask about the National Security Leaders for America, a bipartisan, a nonpartisan group.
I think that we are bipartisan because we have Democrats, we have independents, we have Republicans, and we are taking a side. But we're a pro-democracy organization. We're not affiliated with any political party. We are looking for candidates that are pro-democracy, and they are facing an anti-democratic opponent.
It's an amazing time we're in, isn't it?
It's unbelievable.
I mean, you know, just before we started talking, Joe Walsh, the former Illinois congressman, stopped by and said hello. And Joe and I have been friends for the last couple of years. He and I were at loggerheads for years while he was in Congress. He was my political chew toy. Now we're fighting on the same side, just what you said, fighting for democracy.
An enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Yeah, it is. Mike Smith, I appreciate you taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick. I appreciate being
Great
here.
Great stuff. Former Rear Admiral in the United States Navy, founder and president of the National Security Leaders for America. Check out their website, nsl4a.org. We'll get links out on social media, how you can take a look at what they do. Going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show.
This is locally grown radio, WFHR. Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mostly clear tonight, low 50s. Mostly sunny and a little warmer tomorrow, touch breezy with a high around 80. A chance of showers and storms Wednesday night and Thursday, high upper 70s. Cooler for the rest of the week. Currently, it's 66.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed. Keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network. Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow, Wisconsin's home for daily conversations about the state's latest headlines and stories. Weekday mornings from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Back here at the UC. It's not the United Center, I'm told by the locals. It's the UC, United Center here in Chicago for the DNC convention. And I'm thrilled to talk to my next guest, a sheriff, a guy who's served in law enforcement 43 years. And I got to tell you, a little surprised. We're supposed to not like law enforcement people on this side of the aisle, which is why I've asked Gary McFadden to come talk with us. He is the sheriff of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg area, the Mecklenburg County Sheriff,
yes.
Right?
Yes, Mecklenburg County Sheriff's Office.
I finally got it right.
You got it.
43 years. Good on you, man.
I love every second of it. This is the best job I've ever had now being sheriff because we are elected by the people.
So let me go where I started, There's a frame out there in the right-wing corporate media that Democrats hate law enforcement. They want to do away with law enforcement. Do you share that thought, that narrative?
Absolutely. We have a problem of meeting all the events that we are invited to. Everybody's going to put their narrative out there that they want their spin on it. But have we sat down with those people and had a conversation in front of an audience? Absolutely not. And they will not invite us.
No, because I get all the time from people that you don't support the police. And I go, I absolutely support the police and law enforcement. It's just I don't support them when they're wrong. When something happens, responsibility and accountability are important.
And you will agree, and I will agree with that. You should not. Because when we take our oath, you should uphold that oath. And when we are out of line, we should be held accountable. 100%.
Because I believe, look, society, we've done too much to put too much work on your back.
Absolutely.
We don't solve enough problems with mental health. We don't solve enough problems with addiction, broken family. There's so much that we heap on law enforcement's back that, one, they're not trained for. And two, they got so much other stuff that they should be doing.
And that's why we're here today, because we're not running for office. We just want our voice to be heard. We have now become the county hospital. We have now become the social worker. We have now trying to do things that the community could handle before it gets to us. Now we have something called graying. I know not everybody has heard that word before, graying. We have people inside my detention center now, 60 to 70 people who are above the age of 60.
Wow.
Mental health, poor health, you know, untreated symptoms that we have to deal with at their age. So we just want somebody to listen to our call, because the sheriffs in America now are becoming the county hospitals.
When did law enforcement become a political football, do you think? Because, you know, look, police have a tough job. They have the tough job of enforcing the laws. And I don't care which side of the aisle you're on. Sometimes you have a problem with being held accountable yourself. I know when I get caught speeding, I got a problem sometimes, too. But when did this become that kind of political football?
When certain people found that it was easy to create a platform to get attention to, and then they all of a sudden pushed the media towards that platform of this is not being right. And also we have social media with also our camera phones and iPhones and everything else documenting it, and then now scrutinizing what we do for those 3 or 4 or 5 seconds. And so we just need to go back to the basics, clarity, understanding, and let's have conversations.
Yeah. Now, I consume a lot of right-wing media. I do that so that my audience doesn't
sure.
have to. And if you listen to them, you would think our cities are a burning hellscape, the cities are burning, the crime rates are crazy, there are MS-13 around every corner. There's this narrative that crime has never been worse in this country, all because, of course, because Joe Biden flipped a switch. You're 43 years you've been doing this.
Not so. We have things, fentanyl is the big issue right now. Fentanyl, a big issue. A while back, it was crack. Same thing. And so what we happen is now that we have more content to view on social media, we have a more platform to talk about it on social media. We make it more prevalent on social media. 43 years of law enforcement, I'm not speaking from a white paper. I'm speaking from what I have seen over the years.
Because, again, I come back to this idea. Now, look, we spent the day in Chicago yesterday, a beautiful city, walked the streets, did all that. I'm not seeing the burning hellscape that I was told this was supposed to be.
They created in pockets. Every city has their own pockets of crime. And so when you magnify that to spread across the country, it looks like it's burning down.
No, let's talk about those pockets, because I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. I was the minority in a minority community, if you get what I'm saying.
Sure.
I'm
a minority now in my community.
So we kind of get it. I always joke that, you know, being the white kid in the black neighborhood, we played this neat game called Chase the White Kid and Beat Him Up. And then I'm half black. The other half was obviously blue. But that was a high poverty area. Crime rates were much higher. Poverty seems to be the thing that walks hand in hand with criminal activity.
Absolutely.
Or am I putting too much into this?
No, sir, you're not. Poverty is the driving force for crime.
So as law enforcement, wouldn't it behoove us to say maybe some social programs to help get jobs into poorer neighborhoods, opportunities of education? Shouldn't you guys be a little more active in the policy realm?
Sure.
Instead of being the poor folks who have to clean up the mess?
Yeah, but sure. Think about how when things happen in law enforcement, it's always this is what you need to do more. You need to be trained more. You need to be when it comes back to the community. Fentanyl in the community, we don't put it out there. The person with mental health, a crisis, that person had that crisis for such a long time.
Yeah.
But only when that person is arrested and inside of our custody, they believe that we need to give them all the care. And if that person dies in our custody, it's our fault.
No, that is a perfect point, because, you know, I think about, I have friends who go, well, if I want to go to college, I'll just go to jail. Because that's been the frame for a while. College costs have been so outrageous that prisoners are getting free college.
Yes.
And you go, just what you said, we're now solving some problems because we have this situation. Wouldn't it be great to maybe do that stuff before people got into trouble?
Well, that's why we're here. So that's why we're here asking our political leaders to give us that platform, give us that time to talk to us, let us help educate them. And that's what we're asking. Listen to law enforcement for one time at for a length of time, not the soundbite. Have a conversation with us, said, how can we help you? How can we retain officers? How can we battle fentanyl? How can we battle mental health? How can we get, you know, and the biggest issue is the borders. So what are we doing? Some people have problem with the borders. Some people have problem with immigration. Two different things.
True, yeah, absolutely.
Yes. Texas, border problems. New York, immigration. Why? Because people move people to New York and drop those people off. So all of these things here are what we wanted to talk about in law enforcement and allow our voices to be heard.
I mean, so that's a political issue, most certainly. And I understood, look, they had an agreement not too long ago, got crushed by the former president. Will we, in your lifetime or my lifetime, get to a solution on the border? Because it's always been my belief that the issue is more important than the solution, that we need that division. We need that dividing topic. We don't want to solve it. It's like the abortion issue.
You do. They want that dividing topic. But imagine this. If you want to help solve a problem, bring people in who have the problem. You have the sheriffs who have the problems. Every sheriff is not going to agree on the border. This is a border problem, immigration problem, two different things. But when you collectively bring all of us together and said, how do you want us to help you? Well, tell us the problems that you have, it'll get solved. But keeping us outside is not solving it.
Right.
So when you have all of your political players talking about an issue that they do not have firsthand knowledge about, you're going to still have a problem.
No, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah. So and this is what we're asking for. Come to our table. Come to our facilities. Invite us to have these long conversations, not just candid conversation, because candid means it's going to come in the room, spend an hour with us, and then the person walks in and said he has to go to the next meeting. Spend days, 1 or 2 days with us inside of our facilities, and you'll see a difference.
Well, walk a mile in my shoes.
Absolutely.
Without question.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, I got to tell you, I don't know how you guys do what you do. To be honest,
we love it.
I get that. But, you know, when the arrows, it's like teachers. I don't know why people are teachers anymore, because the arrows that keep being slung at them. So you've got to obviously have a retention problem, a recruitment problem, you know, all of that stuff.
This is why on this sheet that we're talking about our priorities, retention is a problem. But let's pay our officers. You think about this. We save lives, but we don't have a $15 million contract.
Well, that's because you can't dunk.
Well, we can dunk. if you allow us to dunk, we can do a lot of dunking. But imagine the people that save lives, the people who deliver babies, the people who run into burning houses, the people who are having custody of a child or having an adult, an 80-year-old adult inside a facility that we have to give custody and care for. Not saying that we need to be paying millions, but you need to recognize the problems that we have.
Well, platitude should be enough. Thank you. No?
Well, a basketball game should be this. This is a rec sport then.
I'm there with you already. No, I mean, the sad reality is, and I was joking, obviously, about the platitudes.
No, but I mean, we love the thank yous, but when we were talking about retention, say if you pay us a decent amount of money.
You can't eat thank yous.
You can't. And so then, but you want us to save your daughter, save your son from the burning house, or he's 35 years old and you want us to put him out of the house because now he's a drug abuser. We are the social workers, the pastors, the doctors, and everybody else. And so not to say that we need millions of dollars, but support us in these priorities that we have. That's it. Retention is one. Retention is one of the things we want to talk about. Retention. We want to talk about fentanyl. We want to talk about the borders. We want to talk about a whole lot of things, but you can't do it in an hour.
Right. Do you feel, I mean, you're here at the Democratic Convention. Do you feel that there is someone listening? Do you feel the Harris-Walls campaign, do you think that they would be more inclined to listen?
Well, we're going to ask them to listen. We can be a very loud voice. 3,189 sheriffs in America, we can be a loud voice.
No, and look, you know.
And we have to.
Absolutely.
We are an elected official just like they are. Respect the position and allow us to work together, and we'll have solutions. Only when we are involved, it is going to work. You can talk about the border. It's not going to resolve unless you form a committee to allow sheriffs to tell you what we could do together to make these things work. Other than that, you're just looking at a white paper and getting somebody with some letters in the front and behind their name to look at a problem that has no actual solvability factors to solve it.
So you got a magic wand.
I do. I do.
Okay, well, then since you've got the magic wand, wave it and fix some of these problems. How do we fix the border?
Allow us as sheriff to be on a committee. Allow sheriffs to have a voice. Allow to listen to the sheriff that says, what is the problem? Some people have a problem with the border. Some people have a problem with immigration. Two different things. Inner side, you know, Texas, Arizona, and all of those border problems. North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, we don't have borders. We just have the conversations about immigration, illegal, undocumented, whatever you want to call it, people.
I have a friend who lives in North Carolina. He wants to put a border on the border of North and South Carolina.
Where does he live in North Carolina? Where does he live?
He lives in Durham.
Oh, that's even worse. Maybe put a border around his. But when you talk to your friend, he's not talking about border issues, right? He's saying immigration.
Yeah, no, that's you're right. We conflate the two issues.
So what happens is it takes a sheriff from the West to talk about borders. It'll take a sheriff from the East to talk about immigration. Oh, so we have two different issues. Yes, but we just put it in under one thing, border.
No,
which is not fair.
I don't disagree. I guess I'm in the position of being a bit jaded, sitting in this chair, that I know our political leaders, they need this as an issue.
This is an issue, but we just don't want it to be a campaign issue. We don't want it to be a talking point issue. We don't want it to be a promise that we will never get anything from it. And that's what I'm asking for. You know, involve the sheriffs. And this is why we're here. Involve the sheriff. You can involve everybody else. Except that elected judicial official who holds the highest position in any county. Most people don't understand that.
No. I get it. Because I think we learned a lot about what sheriffs do during the pandemic.
Right.
And what we found out a little bit is it's a mixed bag politically, leaning more towards not here.
Well, here's why. Because they have that constitutional power to do whatever they want to do in their county.
Right.
They are the king of their counties.
And you are the king of Mecklenburg County.
Absolutely. And I can be the king at this convention, too.
So how do we get you there?
To where? Here?
No, here. How do we solve the problem? Because, I'm 100% with you.
We've
got a border issue that we have to solve.
Unless.
We've got an immigration issue. We got fentanyl. We got youth problems. We got problems.
But here's what I'm going to say. Look at any of those issues and see how much is an elected sheriff involved with the conversations. Look at it when you hear when you read the right white paper or you read the research or you read, you know, whatever they did. They do not involve the duly elected sheriff of that county. They bypassed it. Until they involve us, until they talk to us, we're still going to have these voices.
No. Look, I'm 100%.
Who's going to fight the fentanyl problem? The sheriffs. Mental health. Who's going to come in contact with the mental, the person who has challenges? The sheriff inside his detention center. Who's going to deal with the crack epidemic or the fentanyl epidemic? The sheriff. Who's going to enforce all these laws? Think about it. The one person who has the ability to deal with all of it does not have a seat at anybody's table. They just have a conversation after they left that table, and on the way out, they say, oh, sheriff, hey, we'll get up with you. So that's why we're here.
No, look, I'm with you. I think you need to have your voice in there because, unfortunately, and don't take this the wrong way, we've all heard that saying that, you know what rolls downhill.
Correct.
You're at the bottom of the hill.
But somebody has to flush that toilet at some point.
That's where we go.
That's right. So whatever we don't get, flush it.
There you go. Sheriff, it was great talking with you. I wish you the best. I'm hoping that they're listening, but I appreciate your time.
If they don't listen, we're going to stand back and watch it burn this time. Because I'm not saying the little we do, but we're going to, we don't want to say that we told you so.
Yeah.
And that's what we don't
want
to hear.
So we're not going to run into that burning building. Is that the message?
No, we're still going to run into it. But we may be watching some TV while we're in there.
Wow. Okay. Sheriff Gary McFadden.
At some point, you have to listen.
I hear you. No, look, I get it. Strong words.
I mean, think about it. Think about this. The person
I get it. I do.
The person who make and fix this car and put the wheels back on, you don't want us to look at the car. You don't want to talk to us. We are here to say, wait a minute. We don't care who comes in office. Let me say this. The sheriff doesn't matter who comes in office. If you can't listen to our priorities, then you are mistaken. And then we're going to get louder and louder and louder. And then what's going to happen?
Well, the hope is that they do listen.
I'm hoping.
The hope is that you're here for a purpose and you get through that.
We are.
Sheriff,
we are.
Appreciate the time.
My pleasure.
Good
My
stuff.
Pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Sheriff Gary McFadden, I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick at thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Back here from the UC in Chicago. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1991. That was the day that a fire killed 25 workers at the Imperial Food Products plant in Hamlet, North Carolina. More than 50 workers were also injured. The plant made chicken products for fast food restaurants and grocery stores. According to an article in the New York Times, the plant was, quote, a warren of ramshackle buildings. The fire started with hydraulic fluid from a ruptured line spraying into gas flames that heated large oil-filled cooking vats. 90 workers were inside when the fire began. Some were able to escape out the main entrance or a loading bay. But the emergency exits of the plant were locked from the outside. A worker said that this was on the order of the company owner, Emmett J. Rowe, to stop workers from stealing chicken. A passerby, Sam Breeden, was interviewed by the Associated Press. He described the tragic scene saying, quote, they were screaming, let me out. They were beating on the door. The people could not force the door open. At the time of the fire, the company had not had a fire inspection in 11 years. An inspection after the fire found 54 willful violations. The company was fined more than $800,000. Although this was the highest fine in the history of North Carolina, it was far less than federal fines for similar workplace disasters. That's because North Carolina has a state-run occupational health and safety program. At the time of the fire, nearly half of the country had state-run safety inspections. And what of the company's owner, Emmett Rowe? He was convicted of 25 counts of involuntary manslaughter, serving just 4 years. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in Two.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I gotta tell you, I like Gary McFadden. And look, you know, both guests that we spoke to at the DNC convention, I thought were fantastic. Rear Admiral Smith and Sheriff Gary McFadden. And you know, and afterwards, in talking with the sheriff, the idea of restorative justice came up, and it's something that, you know, we spent a little time talking with my producer about. And, you know, for those who don't know, restorative justice is not just crime and punishment. It's not about retribution. It's about trying to repair the harm that's been done by criminal behavior. It's not just focused on punishment. Punishment's there, but also on healing and reconciliation. You know, a paradigm shift, if you will, from the, you know we're going to. It's all about punishment and retribution. Restorative justice offers a shift in that and how we think about crime, accountability, community, and all that stuff. And at its core, it's based on the idea that crime is not merely a violation of law, but a violation of relationships, a violation of the community. When a crime occurs, there's a ripple effect that harms people beyond the immediate victim of the family. It's the communities, it's the offenders themselves, it's everything all along. It's even the offender's children. So this idea of trying to figure out how to make the community whole, as opposed to just punishing the individual, which we've done quite well. Thank you very much. We've done a very nice job of profitizing punishment. Look, the traditional system, you know, emphasizes punishment, you know, which you know, a lot of victims feel overlooked. A lot of offenders feel alienated. And this idea of restorative justice could help address all of that. And it's, you know, this idea that, you know, there's a one size fits all. This is saying maybe there are other ways of going about things. You know, when I was younger, you know, people were given, if you did something stupid, you were given the chance to go to jail or go to the military. A lot of people who, you know, are a little bit older than me remember that option. Judges gave alternate sentences of, you know, go clean up the park instead of whatever. there are better ways of doing this in some cases. Not all, because look, ultimately, there are violent offenders that they're the only thing they understand is punishment. But with this, you know, some of the research that's been done, some of the research that I've looked at, you've got, you know, everyone all around seems to be better with the outcome. Victims are often more satisfied with the outcomes because they have a voice. They have some agency in their journey towards understanding and you know, coming to peace with whatever happened. Their healing, if you will. And, you know, ultimately, you know, seems like a way for a community to be better off. Now, as I said, you know, clearly not all crimes are equal. There are violent offenses that where the power dynamics are complicated, and you're going to need the kind of retribution, I guess. But ultimately, even that requires commitment to genuine engagement from everybody. And not every victim or offender is going to be ready to participate. But there's an opportunity in these moments to do things a little bit differently. So to have a sheriff like Gary McFadden, who's thinking outside of the box, because look, you know, he's not wrong. A lot of our societal problems falls at the door of the jailhouse. I go back to, you know, my childhood and remembering a lot of the guys that came home from Vietnam and how they were just dumped into our communities with all kinds of problems, you know, all kinds of, you know, PTSD, drug and alcohol, broken minds, broken bodies, you know, all kinds of, you know, coping, failure to cope with returning to civilization. And there was literally nothing at the time. And I remember them being rounded up occasionally by the police and taken away. And then, you know, back at some point down the road and no better. So it was about the punishment. It was about, you know, I guess, extracting what you could instead of trying to make lives better. And I think once we get past the want for revenge, I think the idea of having people not commit crimes in the future and giving them avenues to being productive citizens, something we should all want. You know, someone, you know, showed me a statistic years ago, and it's been a number of years since I've looked at this, but the cost to incarcerate someone for a year far exceeds the cost to educate them, to house them, to clothe them. It's insane the amount of money that we spend on retribution, on punishment. And that we don't spend it on the front end, on prevention. You know, I grew up at a time and with people who, you know, some of them became criminals. Some of them went to jail. Some of them were delinquents. You know, poverty has a way of doing that. Growing up in high poverty communities, you tend to have that kind of outcome. And I look at myself, I could have taken the wrong path if not for a union job that gave me hope and a future and an outlook that I can do better. And the ability to lead a life, quite frankly, and I've said this before, that I couldn't have imagined as a young child. So when your only vision of your future is negative and your only vision of your future is what I can grab for myself now, there's a problem. And as a society, we should be working to change that outlook. To help people in high poverty situations, to help people in desperate need of assistance. But that comes through an activist government. That comes through a government who's willing to reach out a hand and help. And I say this all the time. If it weren't for investments of our government in me, I would not be here today. If it weren't for the food stamps that helped us eat and the housing assistance that kept a roof over our head or the health care I got when I had a major asthma attack that landed me in the hospital for weeks. The survivor benefits when my mother passed. Those bits of assistance helped create someone who's paid my share back and wanted there for someone in the future. I think that's the important part. I want to hear your thoughts. email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Anything I said made you think, made you mad, made you happy, made you sad, want to hear about it, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the show, get to podcast or freespeech.org for the video. As always, appreciate your time. Appreciate you being here. Thanks for tuning in. We will see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com.
This is locally grown radio. WFHR 1320 AM. W248 DE Wisconsin Rapids. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.